Hey, podcast listeners. You're listening to a recording made in Los Gatos on the 11th of May, 2015. That's different from that date you're about to hear. That's for the broadcast listeners. Anyway, thanks for downloading. This is Geek Speak for Saturday, May 16th, 2015. We are broadcasting from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. This is KUSP Public Radio 88.9 and KUSP.org. And ladies and gentlemen, it's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. Please keep in mind that the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP or any of the geeks' affiliated organizations. I'm geek translator Bonnie Jean Primsch, and with me in the studio is Ben Jaffe, a teacher, web developer, traveler, and music geek.
Hey, guys.
Hey, Ben. Also, Lyle Troxell, maker, photographer, father, and senior user interface engineer at Netflix.
Hello.
Hi, you guys. Here we are again in the chair, telling people about the geeky things that have been happening in the world.
In chairs. Plural.
We're not all in one chair today.
Not today. But later on, there will be an all-one chair episode of Geek Speak. It will involve many laps, one chair. Lyle, will you tell us about what's going on with net neutrality? That's a story we've been following for
definitely been following
a
along.
Period of time.
As you may recall, we had a kind of win in the FCC's declaration a while ago that the ISPs would be part of the common carrier group, and that general concept would be that they'd fall under this umbrella that phone companies have fallen under a long time, that enforce certain regulations for the carrier to be sharing their service.
Right, that seems like a necessary part. If net neutrality was going to be a possibility, the FCC has to be able to regulate them.
That's correct.
And to regulate them, net access has to be a utility.
Yeah, and they have to be under this common carrier to be part of that. Exactly.
Right. Yeah.
And so, of course, five broadband industry trade groups filed a petition to put a stay on the reclassification of ISPs to be common carriers.
Surprise!
Yeah, of course, we expected them to do that. The good news is that the groups failed to convince the FCC that they were likely to win in court with that argument.
That makes me really happy.
Yeah. So I'll go ahead and read the FCC's response. Petitioners have failed to demonstrate that they are likely to secede on the merits. The commission's classification of fixed and mobile BIAS, that's broadband internet access service, as telecommunication services falls well within the commission's statutory authority, is consistent with Supreme Court precedents, and fully complies with the Administrative Procedure Act. So basically, FCC said, no, it stands, which is a really big good win for net neutrality.
It is, but let me just ask you this question. If the ISPs are wanting to to not be classified as common carriers, why is it that they have to convince the person who wants to call them common carrier? You know, like the entity FCC is like, convince us. Oh, surprise, you didn't convince us because we really want this thing.
Right. Well,
so that doesn't seem that fair.
Yeah, the general argument would be that since a large group of ISP, you know, five different industry groups, that's a lot of different companies, are saying, this is wrong.
Yeah.
Their petition could be kind of reviewed internally the FCC. So the FCC made a judgment, reclassified them, and then with their protest would probably bring that to a higher level of debate at the FCC. I think in this situation, the FCC thought long and hard before they made the ruling to reclassify these ISPs as common carriers. So it's not surprising they said no.
No, dude, we already thought about this.
But the point is that without that step, the ISPs can't take the FCC to court. So now the next step will be the FCC to sue. I'm sorry,
the common carriers to sue the FCC for not being allowed to go to court.
Which means we're talking about years probably before that's even heard in court.
Oh,
which means that for the time being, the reclassification stands, which means all the rules that are applied to FCC to these ISPs stand, which means they can't filter your broadband content.
Okay.
They can't charge you different rates for different access. big wins, possibly temporarily until the courts come into play, but even a few years of this could be very beneficial.
Because then everyone will get used to it. And then they'll say, hey, ISPs, don't take away my cheese.
Momentum's half of technology, I have to say.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's very exciting. More good news for net neutrality, really.
Absolutely.
And what's happening with self-driving cars? That's another favorite topic here at GeekSpeak.
So recently, one of the people behind Google's self-driving car program, Chris Urmson, he's the director of the program, he wrote an article. It was published on Medium. And it just gives a couple stats about car accident frequency and all of that, and then kind of where self-driving cars stack up.
Now, so this is accident frequencies among regular people driving cars.
Yeah, regular people. So in terms of fatalities, 33,000 people die on America's roads every year. The article says
that's a lot of people.
It's a lot of people, and it's just humans are not good at driving. Even the ones who are good at driving are not good at driving. Humans just have latency built in. You know, you can't react instantaneously, and you can't always do the right thing. And that's one of the pushes for self-driving cars. That's one of the arguments for it, is that computers can react instantaneously. They don't have blind spots in their vision. They can look all the way 360 degrees around, whereas we have, I don't know what, like 160
Depends
degrees
on if you're a bird or not, I think.
Or an owl-type bird.
That's right.
If you're an owl-type bird, you do better.
Can birds apply for driver's licenses?
Well, let's hope not.
I don't think so.
They're agitating for change.
Right. So a couple other things. The most common accidents that any of us are likely to run into in a typical day, light damage, no injuries, that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. A lot of these are not reported to police, and so it's kind of difficult to actually get accurate statistics on how many of these happen. But the estimations are about 55% of all crashes are these light damage, no injury crashes.
Right. For instance, I did not report to the police when I backed up into my boyfriend's trailer hitch and put a hole in my bumper.
Did you only damage your vehicle and not his trailer hitch?
Yes.
That's good for your relationship.
You don't drive a self-driving car.
I do not drive a self-driving car.
Now, it is very important to say to point out before we give
Wait
any
a
of
minute.
These statistics.
No one drives a self-driving car. Ben,
that's actually not true. Hang on. You can get paid $20 an hour to drive or to be the safety driver in Google's self-driving cars.
You're like a self-driving car monitor.
If you're successful, you don't actually drive.
Yeah, and you know, a lot of people might be thinking, wow, what an awesome job. At the same time, it's much more boring than driving a truck.
Because you have to pay attention, too.
You have to pay attention, but you're just sitting there, you know?
You can't do anything.
Slowly feeling obsolete.
They should give you beep, boop buttons just to keep you occupied.
Yeah, right. So actually, as it turns out, these cars are quite often manually driven as well. So of the 1.7 million miles that their fleet has driven over the past years, the cars have self-driven almost 1 million of those miles. So that's a bit over 50% of it.
For something I can't get in and take a ride in, there have been a lot of miles clocked.
A lot of miles.
Self-driving cars.
They drive all the time, you know? 10,000 self-driven miles a week, and their fleet is only around 20 self-driving cars. So that's
a lot
of
miles. Yeah. Well, I'd assume when you have a self-driving car, as long as you fill it up and service it, it can be on the road all the time. It's not like our vehicles, which mostly sit because we mostly sit.
Exactly.
That's a good point.
Much better use of the vehicles.
So they also released information on how many accidents they've been involved in. This is really exciting, but we should also take it with a grain of salt because this is not public. These are not public records.
Oh.
These are Google's reports of their own accidents.
So guys, don't tell. Well, it's not public.
No, it's
more
that
to be public record. Let me tell you,
it's more that if they wanted to, they could misrepresent these numbers in various ways.
They're
probably
not.
All right. But just a grain of salt. 11 minor accidents is what they say. Mm-hmm. And over the last 6 years, their various vehicles have been involved in 11 minor accidents, no injuries. And not once, they say, quote, not once was the self-driving car the cause of the accident.
Mm-hmm. I can believe that.
So that's good. If I had someone to monitor my driving and I did not think they were being a busybody, I might also improve my own driving record.
Mm-hmm.
That's the thing, right? You've got a person there, right there, making sure everything's good. I wonder how many times the non-driver of the self-driverless car had to take control.
Intervening. Especially in construction zones.
Did they report that?
Signage isn't... No, they did. They didn't really talk about that.
We have heard that in the past, that during road conditions that seem not standard, the driver in the vehicle actually takes over. And so therefore,
which makes sense.
Those are when accidents normally happen. You know, like it's hard to use these numbers as a relation to how safe the vehicle is, in the sense that they're doing everything possible, they're not speeding. All of those things actually would increase everybody's driving records.
That's true. But if a human took over a self-driving car, then they would be just as likely to get into an accident in those particular things as anyone else would.
Yeah.
So you would expect to see a similar rate, I suppose.
All right.
Granted,
pretty cool.
Not very statistically significant, all this stuff.
Yeah. But it bodes well for the future development of self-driving cars.
Yeah. Now, a couple other interesting things that this article pointed out. A lot of people aren't paying attention to the road. So because their safety drivers can just kind of look around and watch other drivers driving, they've observed a lot of people doing things that they shouldn't be doing when they're driving. So their estimation is...
like grooming while driving?
I'll get to that. Their estimation is, in any given daylight moment in America, there are 660,000 people behind the wheel who are checking their devices.
Yeah.
Instead of watching the road.
That makes sense.
Which is
so sad.
Yeah, it's
a very, very high number to me. Also, it says, quote, our safety drivers routinely see people weaving out of in and out of lanes. We've spotted people reading books and even one playing a trumpet.
Why? Why would you play a trumpet? That's
well,
ridiculous.
In case you didn't get your practice in before you have to go to your lesson.
But a trumpet, like, that takes a lot of parts of your body.
Actually not. Someone told me that, and I said,
you can play with one hand.
You can play with one hand.
Yeah.
Yeah, then you don't have to go, wah, 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 with the toilet plunger.
Yeah, you can't do the mute.
It's called a mute.
Fancy musician, man.
Better a trumpet than a guitar, but I'd prefer them not playing any other instruments other than their voices. So, the article goes on. I'm not going to cover any more, but the article goes on with pictures of various scenarios that the self-driving cars reacted to and some close calls and kind of how their system handled it. It's really interesting to see. It's at the very least a very interesting read, and it is up on our website at geekspeak.org.
Great, and that's an article from Medium, and you'll be able to read that at geekspeak.org.
Bonnie, have you heard of Medium?
It's cropping up more and more, and I realize I don't know when it started or how it got to be such a great source of information.
They just host articles that other people write, right?
So Medium is a blogging tool, kind of like Tumblr.
Oh.
It basically is a forum of a place to write.
Okay.
And it's got really cool features. One of the nice features about it, you have a Medium account and the other person's writing a Medium account, you can actually make comments and dialogue along with the story. So it has a really cool interface for that. Their tagline kind of is inspired, enraged, or otherwise engaged by something you just read. And it's kind of like, you know, get involved, read, write, and so on. Huh. So I really like the system. You can use your Twitter account on Medium to sync up. So if you already have a Twitter account, you can log in through it. And then it kind of uses the same Twitter name, I think. At least it is in my case.
Okay, so you can publish an article on Medium and it'll go patweep.
Yeah, and they've got a great little iOS app that I use to read stories. And a couple people that I like in the JavaScript community write on Medium. And so it's easy for me to follow them and find them.
Huh,
that's just a publishing system for free. I don't know how they make their money. Probably.
Yeah, it just seems like a lot of the more interesting things that we've been talking about on GeekSpeak lately have come from Medium.
Yeah.
And it's also sort of linked to like interesting things I see on my Facebook wall and so on.
It's interesting. Show up come Medium. From Medium versus were surfaced on Medium. Whereas Medium is not the location from which the story comes, but the platform upon which the story is posted.
Right.
So
for the longest time, I thought the other way.
So like interesting people are showing up there. Interesting folks are clumping at Medium.
Clump.
I wanted to read some quotes from them, but it's such a commercial enterprise that it's clearly, they're like, we're the best. Come use your us. You know, I can't
really. Well, then we don't need to quote that. They can speak for themselves.
Very compelling.
You know what I am interested in hearing about, Lyle? It's a while ago, at the bell tolled, we were all excited because Internet Explorer was dying.
Mm.
But I hear it was just renamed.
Yeah, I'll tell you that in a minute.
Okay, good. This is Geek Speak here on KUSP. Fans of this program, consider also checking out the 7th Avenue Project, which airs Sundays at noon at 88.9, or as a podcast from the talk section of KUSP.org. Every week, Robert talks with a bright mind in the arts or sciences, and we all get to listen in. That's the 7th Avenue Project, Thinking Persons Radio, with Robert Polly, tomorrow at noon on KUSP, or anytime you like at his website, 7thAvenueProject.com, or the talk section of KUSP.org. Right now, you're listening to Geek Speak on KUSP. I'm Bonnie Jean Primsch, and with me is Lyle Troxell and Ben Jaffrey, and we were just going to talk about the rebirth of Internet Explorer, which is called something else now.
Mm-hmm. But aren't we waiting on that?
Yeah, but I guess we'll talk about that later.
Its new name is Edge, and I want to tell you all about it.
Okay, so we'll catch up with Edge a little bit later. But first, visuals. We
Edge
love visuals
sounds
on
familiar.
This show.
Yes, I have, what are we calling these days? A
web extra.
A web extra.
Yeah.
Something that's better to see than to hear described on radio. So I'm just going to very briefly describe it on the radio, enough to get you to go online and look it up.
At geekspeak.org is the domain name.
Yeah. This is a YouTube channel called Smarter Every Day. Have you heard of it?
Oh, yeah. Wow. Oh, yeah.
The guy who does it reminds me of you. Like, you kind of have this
he's awesome.
Passion about the world and explaining it and figuring out how things work.
Who is the dude?
Basically, what it is. So here's the entirety of the description. I explore the world using science. That's pretty much all there is to it. Watch two videos. If you learn something awesome, subscribe. Huh. And he has all kinds of videos. He's got like a lot of slow motion videos, like helicopters flying in slow motion. You can watch what tattooing looks like in slow motion. That one's kind of gross. How cats flip upside down if you drop them upside down, how they flip.
Huh.
And the video that I just totally fell in love with this channel again. He made, his coworkers made a bike where when you turn the handlebar left, instead of the wheel turning left, it turned the opposite way. And so the handlebars on the wheels were reversed. And, you know, people say it's like riding a bicycle. Well, he actually got himself to unlearn how to ride a bicycle.
By
riding this backwards bike. Eventually, he got it after like 8 months.
It's really hard to do.
Yeah, that's a brain teaser.
Yeah, he gave a smaller version to his kid and said, here, learn this. And the kid just like picked it up.
Immediately.
Yeah.
Because he hadn't learned the bike, so he didn't have to unlearn the bike.
I'm not going
to
tell you more about this, but the video is about 7 minutes long. It is absolutely charming.
Again, that's Getting Smarter Every Day.
Getting Smarter Every Day.
It's just Smarter Every Day.
It is Smarter Every Day.
Yeah, Smarter Every Day.
And really, like, you could spend so many hours on this channel.
And I have.
Not waste, spend, and learn.
Yeah.
It's fantastic.
All right, so this one is Smarter Every Day, number 133, The Backwards Brain Bicycle.
And that will be at geekspeak.org for, of course, this episode of GeekSpeak, which is the 11th of May, 2015.
Or whatever this Saturday is.
Right.
That's what the Saturday is. 11th of May is today.
Oh my gosh. The 16th of May.
The 16th of May is today. Oh gosh.
There you go.
Pre-recording a show is so confusing.
It's difficult. All right. Usually in the show, we've been experimenting these days with just having a good long discussion. It's nice to get updates on what's happening in the geek world. But there ought to be a space for, you know, the big topics. And one thing, of course, that appears to be happening, although I don't really pay attention, is the reduction of our attention spans. You got your tweeting, you got your computer that'll tell you every time your Facebook updates, and it's hard to pay attention in this modern world.
Yeah, there's an article I found just kind of, it's called Losing Focus, Why Tech is Getting in the Way of Work. And it made me think that this could be an interesting discussion topic. So just a couple stats from the article. Back in 2004, they followed some American information workers around with stopwatches and timed how long they spent on different tasks before they got distracted. Mm. And
just general people they followed?
American information workers.
Okay.
So this
was
is...
Did the information workers agree to this? Because
yes.
It sounds a little creepy.
No. You're
who's
right,
that
right,
guy
right.
Recording everything I say?
So this is 11 years ago. Mm-hmm. And they found that, quote, they switched their attention every 3 minutes on average. 3 years ago, they did a similar thing, and they found that the time spent on one computer screen before switching to another computer screen was not 3 minutes, it was 1 minute and 15 seconds. And by the summer of 2014, just last year, it was an average of 59 and a half seconds.
Oh
so
my gosh.
It went from a minute 15, and then in 2 years,
we
or
lost
2 years and change.
Seconds.
Yeah, it's 80% that time. So basically, attention spans are getting shorter and. What am I talking about?
I don't know. I forget why it's a problem.
So this article goes around and kind of like talks about all these different ways to manage your attention. Like they're talking about how some recent studies showed a potential connection between treadmill desks and improved memory and concentration. So if you're walking, then maybe somehow that stimulates your brain in a different way. There's also the Pomodoro technique where you spend 25 minutes working and then you give yourself a 5-minute break not working. And that 5-minute break, or it could be also a reward of some sort, a snack or something like that.
My problem with that one is I start my 5-minute break and then it takes a lot long. You know, like then 2 hours later, I'm like, I got to get back to that thing.
So I guess my question is, we'll start with you, Bonnie. What do you do to concentrate when you're having trouble concentrating on something?
For me, I need a really clear structure. So it helps me if I have like an intention of getting through this list. And then timing it out, like from 10 to 10:15, I'm going to do that from 10:15, and then I just check it off as I go. That helps.
You mean so you set up your entire day like that?
Yeah.
And okay. Do you actually end up following it, or do you tend to change your list as you go?
On the days I do that.
I see.
But a minority, I will say this, a minority of the days have that amount of sort of focus and structure that I actually start off with a solid list like that. Hmm. If I'm groggy at all in the morning or squirrel, I see squirrel before I get to making
something
that
exciting
list
on the internet.
Yeah, then it just doesn't happen. So it's not a reliable way for me, but with determination, that is the way that works for me.
That's interesting.
What about you, Lyle? What do you do when you need to concentrate?
What was the question?
Well, we'll keep making that joke.
Yeah, sorry. So I guess as a developer, as a programmer, one of the things to be successful as a programmer is you really have to be able to get yourself into a flow. Mm-hmm. And that requires setting a large set of context. Because what you're doing is you're writing a story in an alternative language that's not your primary language with a lot of math involved. And I'm trying to kind of summarize what programming is like. To do that, all of the language of the program and the language you're writing the program in has to be kind of in the concept of your mind. And that's a large set of conceptual things to stick in your brain.
So you really have to be in that world to program.
To get anywhere. Uh-huh. So if the task is relatively complicated, meaning a lot of these different pieces of the application, you really have to take some time to build that context up for yourself. I could do this more directly if you want to hear about like the application I work on.
I could, but can I tell you what I'm imagining first?
Yeah.
My mom, who was also a computer programmer and would still do it on the side just to amuse herself.
Because once you start, you can't stop. It's
right.
Awesome.
I think that's probably it. Like she quit and she kept working on the things she was working on because she just wanted to see how it would work out. But what she would do is write up a whole outline of what she wanted program to do, and then she would code.
So when I start off applications, I normally sketch that kind of thing on paper in kind of a visual way because I'm a pretty visual learner. Mm-hmm. So I'll do diagrams and things. And that is a definite important thing when you start tackling the problem. But the actual details of each of those steps become pretty relatively complex.
Right.
The reason I'm bringing this all into mind is that if I lose focus, if I stop focusing on that, that whole structure collapses. And 10 minutes later, I'll have to reset that.
Right.
So the kiss of death is someone coming over and saying, hey, Lyle, you got a minute? Tapping you on the shoulder?
I can distract myself for about 10 minutes and still be in context.
Okay.
Still work that way. And more directly, because normally the questions that interrupt me are very common to the task at hand. There's similarities in it.
Okay.
And so to be clear, I'm talking right now about my experience at Netflix programming the mobile app. So I work on the iOS app with a team of about 20 people.
Okay.
So if you're on an iPhone or an iPad and you use Netflix on it, that's the application I work on.
Mm-hmm.
And in that space, we have to deal with things like profile switching and the concepts of lists of videos and then similar videos. So there's a lot of concepts that are something you'd be familiar with because you kind of understand what a profile is or a user account.
Mm-hmm.
And then the videos you might be engaging with. But the concepts of how you build the structure of the view of looking at that stuff has a whole bunch of language around it. And so though I'm trying to solve a simple problem like displaying the bookmark bar, which is the red bar where you were playing a film or a video, though I'm talking about that, I'm actually talking about like 6 different methods that go into building that thing and how that's structured. So in any case, that 10 minutes distraction works. More than that, not good at all. And the way I stay focused is I really care about what I do. I like doing that. That challenge is engaging with my mind. The times when I have trouble with focus is when I'm bored.
That's the worst.
Right, right. Don't you guys feel that way?
When I don't like anything on my list.
Yeah.
Yeah. Bleh.
That definitely is a problem. So if there's a task at hand that I'm not interested in doing, then I'll distract the heck out of myself.
Yeah.
Right? Then it's the cat videos or whatever.
Then
it is.
Isn't there a squirrel somewhere?
Right.
Yeah. And what about you, Ben? How do you keep yourself tuned in?
It's really interesting because So I kind of do two things at work. So I work at Udacity and I'm a course developer and I do front-end web development. So part of the time I'm building things using front-end web development generally, mm-hmm. And HTML and CSS and JavaScript. I'm actually writing code kind of similar to what you do, Lyle. And the other half of the time I'm planning out courses and I'm searching outside of myself oftentimes for inspiration. Mm-hmm. So when
it's
I'm
like licensed to surf.
Right. So I mean, like the best thing for me today, I was thinking about a course that I've been planning out. And I was just walking around the office and saying like, hey, given this technology, what was the hardest thing for you to learn? What was the hardest thing for you to learn? What was the hardest thing for you to learn? So
were
I was kind of
quizzing
like,
folks.
You were asking people that you work with?
I was asking people that I work with, right? So in a way, I was kind of mono-focusing on the project, but I wasn't really focusing on any individual part of it,
right.
And I was really kind of bouncing around a lot.
So when that's kind of a brainstorming activity, yeah?
Yeah, it was really good in terms of brainstorming, but when I'm actually writing code, I do have to sit down. I have to kind of isolate myself a little bit. I sit right by the lunch area at Udacity, and that is absolutely horrible for my productivity when I'm trying to solve a difficult problem.
Do you
people coming by and also delicious smells?
Absolutely. There are a lot of friendly people.
Do you block out the outside sound with music or anything for your ears?
I found at first that helped. I'm also a musician, and it can be distracting to listen to music, but I found that actually just wearing headphones without playing music works very well for me.
Well, it also tells the people around you not to bother
you. Yes, that's half of it. People don't approach you when you have big honking headphones on.
I'm not a musician, so I can listen to music as long as there's not a lot of vocals. If there's no vocals in music, I'm fine. It can be pretty much any style of music as long as there's not a story, a narrative of some sort that I hook into.
Yeah.
That will be distracting to me.
Yeah. Also, I have done kind of a version of the Pomodoro method of doing, some amount of focus and then some amount of break, some amount of focus, some amount of break. Mm-hmm. And actually for me, sometimes I even do half an hour of focus and then 15 whole minutes of break because that's so much more productive than if I'm just kind of, bouncing around and not really concentrating at all.
I would say that the other side of this is that if there's a problem in front of me, I can't not think about that. So I was doing a whole bunch of electrical work at my property yesterday, doing Mother's Day watering stuff. And when I was doing that, I looked at the clock at one point, and I'd spent 2 hours working on a kind of a computer programming problem. It's a water and electrical flow problem. It's very similar, circuitry kind of stuff. And I had been doing all that without even thinking about it. I'm freezing. Mosquitoes are biting me. So I don't have a problem with focus from that regard, I guess.
Well, it sounds like it gets back to when I'm engaged with the problem, there's not a problem.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So really, it's about finding stuff that you're interested in and doing those things. So what about when you've got a task that's ridiculously dull?
Yeah.
How do you deal with
that? A lot of us don't have the luxury of work that's scintillating and engaging at every moment.
Yeah.
Like there's like the dull parts. There's always the dull parts.
I hope no one that you work with is listening to you right now.
Well, no. I mean, it's like in anything, right? There's the mystery, which is like the juicy thing that you get to do. And then there's there's ministry, which is just administering, like in all the paperwork that teachers have to do or the office politics.
That's a really good distinction to make. Yeah. Because I don't tend to think much about the boring work unless I'm really bored with it. Then it's just horrible.
I think in programming, it normally falls into the documentation of what you're doing is rarely the things that people are excited about. I actually kind of like doing that, but
some people
probably
don't
do it enough.
Yeah. Actually, for that, I put on repetitive music. Like I put on some kind of electronic music, not the really deep, but like just kind of repetitive and it has momentum. It keeps me moving through my task just as the music keeps moving.
I find that's the case for me if I'm doing printmaking or something, because there's coming up with the image, right? Mm-hmm. But then there's just the, and I made one print and now I made another print, and it could get dull if you're like, oh, but with the right music can kind of maintain the space.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So that it's possible for me to kind of keep in that sort of artistic space and not go, isn't there a snack somewhere or something? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's the beat of it. It's the beat of it. Yeah.
Yeah.
So what,
the flow, if you will.
The flow is the term that you use quite a bit in programming. Mm-hmm. Okay, so the last thing that I've noticed about attention spans, has to do with not attention spans, but staying focused or staying present. Let's not talk about it as attention span, but like being present. Mm-hmm. So, for example, being around the house, right, and the kids are running around or the dog is wants me to throw a ball or whatever, it's very easy for me to pull up a mobile device and look at Facebook really quick.
Yeah.
And then put it away. Yeah. Not that I'm therefore completely distracted from the world around me. I'm still kind of engaged. But that's there at all means that something about the current present moment isn't as powerful.
Yeah.
That's the piece that distracts me. Not the work, but more of the social of being potentially distracted. We have this taboo in our society, I think, in general, about using your phone in a restaurant or when you're with people and you're engaged in a meal.
Our
right?
generation does. I'm not sure if younger generations have that.
I don't think my generation does, but
Children generation does, but it has to be enforced by us, the parents.
Right.
So I do find that when I sit down with people, I'm pretty good about not using the device. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But when I'm walking around or doing other things, it pops up in my hand all the time. When I say it pops up in my hand, it's not like I'm consciously going, well, this moment right now needs to be filled with digital distraction. Mm-hmm. And yet there I am looking
at
Facebook.
Ooh, shiny.
Shiny.
Your phone buzzes and you just want to see what it is. And
So the question I've got is, what about the society that just doesn't have boredom anymore, doesn't have slowness? When I walk 3 flights of stairs between my office floors, right, I look at my phone unless mm-hmm. I'm talking with somebody, right? Mm-hmm. What about that time when you're just not engaged with media, not engaged at all, and just walking?
That is my best productive time.
Yeah, I would agree.
I couldn't fall asleep last night from 10 to 2 a.m. It was 4 hours, but it was not horrible. I mean, it was horrible because I had to wake up at 5:30 in the morning, but I got so much creative thought done.
Yeah.
I kept laying down. I had one thought. I kept thinking, oh, I'll just hold on to this thought and go to bed. I'll remember it in the morning. Then I'd get another thought. Oh, I guess I have to get up and write this down and, you know, like.
Yeah, okay.
But man, I woke up this morning and I had this huge document filled with ideas and I just got to process it this morning. It was awesome.
And that's one reason why people are panicked, right? If we're getting rid of the downtime, the dull time, then you're also getting rid of a lot of opportunities for creativity to come in.
Yeah.
And, have a thought grow.
And it compresses your entire experience. In audio work, one of the things we do, like I'll do this at the end of the podcast tonight, I'll take the entire audio file and I'll do a compression on it. That'll make the lows be higher and the highs be lower to kind of neutralize the sound so that there's not a lot of variation because it's an easier thing to hear and a louder thing to hear. Mm-hmm. Common. What we're doing with our time is we're compressing it like that. We used to have these lulls of boredom, and now every moment we keep our mind active. Yeah. And that lull has a real integrity. It has an intensity and it has a meaning. And if we nullify it, we get rid of that whole aspect of being a human. That's the part that concerns me.
Mm. And it's easy to go to the doom and gloom, like, uh-oh, how are we screwing it up? An interesting area will be to find out, what are we gaining?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We clearly are, right?
What happens, what good happens from having those kind of dull moments filled?
Yeah. What's the overstimulated human being like after years? Maybe it's more productive.
Maybe so. Well, you're listening to Geek Speak here on KUSP. When we come back, we really are going to talk about Edge, the new name for Internet Explorer, and just if it's any darn big deal at all.
Let's just keep pushing this like episode to episode to episode.
Yeah, next week, we really are going to talk about Edge. Thanks for listening. We'll be right back. It's Geek Speak here on KUSP. I'm Bonnie Jean Primsch, your geek translator, with geeks Ben Jaffe and Lyle Troxell. So,
Internet Explorer?
It is not dead.
No. So Microsoft, and I feel like we covered this last week on GeekSpeak, but we'll go into it anyway.
We'll cover it again.
Yeah. I think what happened is I got so excited about this, I told everybody I knew, and therefore it felt like a GeekSpeak episode.
Well, we did talk earlier that they had a code name for it, that they were moving away from the IE name.
What was the code name?
Code was Spartan or something like that?
Yeah, I think so.
Some kind of...
So Microsoft for a while has been rebuilding the Internet Explorer engine. Internet Explorer, the browser released by Microsoft, which became very popular because of its tie-in with Windows. So if you were running Windows, you got Internet Explorer, this browser.
Yeah.
And they added some really great features, which actually turned into kind of a security nightmare. One of those was...
This was back a long time ago.
Back in the day, 2000s.
Aughts. Yeah.
Yeah. And one of the things they provided was an interface to run what was called ActiveX components. These are actual machine process level applications that would run inside your browser, and people made plugins for these. And what this means is that, let's say you've got an application that you've already written in-house and you had to install on people's computers. Now, all they have to do is run Internet Explorer. They visit a web page. It starts that application with a little prompt, are you sure you want to run this? And then that application had complete access to your computer like a normal application. Mm-hmm. It was kind of like Java on steroids.
The time-saving device, yeah?
Yeah.
It makes things load faster, is that
Well,
true?
I wouldn't say like load faster. Do things you couldn't do normally. For example, you could have an ActiveX component, which was a full audio editing suite. Mm. It would run inside your browser, but it would actually be running outside your browser. So it was kind of a hook to make applications run. Businesses love this because it allowed them to run more complicated applications,
but launch them through.
Yeah, launch them through the browser. Yeah. So ActiveX was a big boon for Microsoft. A lot of corporations went to Internet Explorer and made it the default browser because it was already there. And then Microsoft kind of stalled out on innovating for a while, for years. And so developers like Ben and I hate Internet Explorer. Was it 4, 5? Every one of them, I think.
4, 5, 6, 7, 8. 9 even.
Because they're always, lagged. You had to lagged. Account well, for like the lowest common denominator was Internet Explorer.
That was pretty problem, much the reason.
Yeah, the problem is IE6, for example, was released in, what, 2000 or 2001?
Sure.
Back around
Somewhere.
That era, right? Mm-hmm. And back in 2012, people are still having to support IE6 when mm-hmm. they build their websites. This is a 12-year-old browser. It's supporting the standards.
Was that entirely IE's fault, or is that about grandma?
I mean, that...
You know, it's...
It's not.
We've learned from the
browser.
Mistake that happened.
Yeah.
What we've done
yeah.
now is we've the developers that make browsers actually make the browser auto update all the time. Mm-hmm. So you don't even know what version of Chrome you're currently running on your
well,
computer.
Well, I have to know it's 42 point something rather because I looked it up yesterday.
That's true. But okay, so Microsoft says the new browser, which is a completely new engine, much more standards compliant. They've been very good on the W3C standards compliance aspect. They will not support ActiveX. They will not support browser helper objects, which means basically no binary plugins.
No low level, none of the stuff that was causing all of the security woes before.
Right. And so, they're actually instead going, and no plugins basically, no Java servlet, no Java support.
Yeah.
Not JavaScript. Java and JavaScript are completely different things. And no Silverlight support, which is actually their technology that was supposed to replace Flash.
And it did not.
There will be Flash support, but it's built into the browser, not by Adobe. And there is a PDF reader. But other than that, no more frills and bells and whistles, except for standard compliant HTML5
and
stuff.
Is that good? Do we need be replaced by other things?
I would say it's great because we've seen Chrome and Firefox, or Mozilla's Project Firefox, mm-hmm. And Google's Chrome do amazing things in web standards, such that you can play video, you can edit audio and video in your browser. There's a whole bunch of standards that have come about that are just fantastic to have universal, because when everyone follows the standards, it doesn't matter what browser you actually use. And basically, Microsoft is fully committed and is joining the party.
Oh, okay.
And
good.
One of the examples
they're
of
catching
that.
Catching up.
Yeah. One of the examples of that, for example, is the ASMJS, which is a subset of JavaScript which runs extremely fast. This is the Firefox showing that they could play the Unreal Engine games in browser. Microsoft has taken that technology too, and their performance is better than Firefox on some metrics. So it's really exciting to have a third player in that space, no offense, Opera, which is the fourth browser that no one uses.
No one uses Opera.
Geek speak punching bag.
I love
so
Opera.
So anyway, congratulations to Microsoft to really kind of pushing this envelope and changing the way they're doing something.
So do we like them? Are they cool again?
Hey, I think I said in the beginning of the year that Microsoft is going to have I'm excited about what Microsoft's doing. Yeah, definitely, it's cool. The other thing that Microsoft's doing is really interesting is the Azure service. It's very much like Amazon's web services, where you can host a virtual machine in the cloud. Mm. And for a while, Amazon's kind of the winner in this space. In fact, all of Netflix, for example, which is 1/3 of internet traffic in the U.S., runs inside of Amazon, right? So it's like Amazon is the powerhouse. And so to have Microsoft doing a pretty good job of virtual machines and those kind of services mm-hmm. is really exciting for that space. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, Microsoft's having a rejuvenation, I think, of some of their tech.
And are big names taking Azure up on what they have to offer?
I would say it's great for developers. I don't know the scale at which they're doing.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that still it's so puny compared to Amazon, it's not even worth mentioning. But the services from a developer's perspective are pretty great.
Right. They also have the Microsoft Band. They're making a foray into wearables. It's kind
Band?
Of like
oh.
It's kind of like a Google Wear device, Apple Watch, but it's a Microsoft Band, and it's kind of also like a Fitbit because it tracks your steps, and it's kind of like.
It's funny when you said that. I really imagined a band as in like you
Me
know
too.
Five four piece you know.
Yeah, who's the drummer? plays bass.
Microsoft is not musical to me, but so are they releasing it? Do they have it available
it's
in
out.
Mass?
Yeah, I
that's
consider
not what you
buying
have on,
it.
Is it?
No, I have a Fitbit.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm tracking my steps. So
you're tracking your hand, your arm movement, Ben. We covered this 2 weeks ago at GeekSpeak, but you weren't here.
If you want to be a pedant, you are tracking, and you are not tracking anything. Your device is tracking it.
2 episodes of Geek Speak, we covered this very well. You could listen to that.
Dr. Don Motika. All right. So I guess we'll stay tuned and see what's going on with Microsoft Edge, but it sounds like the Geek Speak word is don't be afraid.
Don't be afraid.
Don't be afraid of it. Okay. You know what I would be afraid of is like driving on the moon.
Oh, yeah.
First of all, I don't think I'd be able to breathe very well.
I hope this is a segue, Bonnie, because that's just a weird thing to be scared about.
Funny you mentioned that. I happen to have a story about this.
I wake up at night scared. Okay.
So this guy, Gregory L. Charvat, went to a Engineering Apollo the Moon Project as a Complex System MIT course, and he met David Scott, who was one of the people who landed on the moon on Apollo 15.
The Scott and Expedition.
This
that's
is
what that was called.
This is just an awesome article, and I'd highly recommend any space geek to read it. I thought I would just read a couple bits of it. First of all, for background of who this guy is, he flew on Gemini 8 with Neil Armstrong, and this was during the stuck thruster incident. And if anyone doesn't know what that was all about, basically one of their thrusters got stuck open and just started spinning and spinning and spinning faster and faster, right. faster. And really, really bad news in space because there is no air. You're
we
not going to
saw gravity. Yeah.
You're just going to keep spinning until you're thrown up against the side and then you black out because of the G forces. But they managed to shut it down and then unspin themselves and then land a little bit early because they didn't have enough fuel anymore. He was also the command module pilot in Apollo 11, which was a test flight, and he landed on the moon as commander of Apollo 15. And this is just a really fun, long article talking about a lot of the things that this guy was talking about. So first of all, he was saying that the simulators that they would train in were remarkably accurate. It says, quote, his recollection was the only difference between the simulation and being on the moon was the fact that you were on the moon.
Wow.
That's
really
those are pretty
like
good
it.
Simulation.
It really felt like it. So they got to the moon and they're like, huh, kind of feels like the simulator, right?
Yeah.
They were hybrid digital and analog systems, it says. David told us that the people running the simulations were trying to kill them by causing a large plurality of alarms, false alarms, system failures, partial failures, and so on. And it required an engineer's mind to solve the puzzle presented by almost any alarm because alarms were not always what they seemed. Mm. And correctly solving this conundrum of machine feedback was a matter of life and death during the real mission.
Wow. Wow. So imagine being in that kind of environment. That's
yeah,
so cool.
Yeah. A bunch of things start buzzing and beeping and flashing at
it's
you
like,
and you're like,
it's uh-oh. Like your fuel light comes on in your car, except what it really means is there's a fire in the back seat.
Right.
And you don't really know.
Right.
Yeah.
You
better
so you
pay attention.
Look around.
You figure it out.
This is a fun one. They talk about abort control on takeoff. So it says, there's an abort control on the left side of the left seat, that's the pilot seat, of the command module. It's a very interesting thing. If you're at the start of your flight, rocketing up with the whole stack, F1 engines going, and you rotate
it. The whole stack means the entire...
all the F1 engines pushing you into space. Yeah. And you rotate it right, then the entire stack is now under manual control, where the pilot in the left seat is manually flying the entire rocket.
Oh, my.
And then you have to make sure that these two things are aligned, and that's how you stay.
Why would you possibly do that? I guess if the computer system shuts down.
So the same handle. If you turn the abort handle left, then the escape rocket at the top of the CM would fire, subjecting the crew to 14 Gs.
But separating themselves from the explosive stuff.
Yes.
Yeah.
No one wanted to rotate it to the left because, as you can imagine, 14 Gs would not feel too good. And aside from personal comfort, the crews were extremely motivated to make things work no matter what happened. Even when Apollo 12 was hit by lightning, causing the electrical systems to go crazy as it was clawing its way into the atmosphere, the abort control was not touched. They still went for it.
They didn't go into manual drive?
No. Wow. Well, yeah. So it's one lever. And if you do it one way, you're manual. If you do the other, you're catapulted out of your spacecraft.
It's really interesting. They give
so handle left was like failure, right? I mean, it
yeah,
sounds
it's abort.
Like
well, that's the
yeah.
thing is it sounds, this is exactly what it sounds like is failure button. And so you have to decide as one of the, as an astronaut to choose failure.
Do I declare
failure.
This a failure?
There's no astronaut to choose that
yeah,
because if you're an astronaut, you don't choose that kind of thing.
You're an astronaut.
Well, I don't know if the wrong things start buzzing at you, maybe you might, you know? There are a lot of things that could go wrong.
I think you and I might do that, but well, I don't think an astronaut would.
Yeah, nerves
of
steel.
That's why we're not astronauts.
And wait, then, what's it like to drive a lunar buggy?
This is the last one I want to read.
This is David Scott's story.
It says, as if you had any doubts, but David confirms the lunar rover was really fun to drive. The vehicle, and this is the first time the lunar rover was brought down on the moon, and they drove it around, right? Mm-hmm. It's this little car, basically. The vehicle had a wide wheelbase, a low center of gravity, and each wheel had its own motor. But there was one occasion that caused a stir when the rover nearly slid down a mountain. David and Jones noticed a green colored boulder on the side of a fairly steep mountain, so they cruised over to it in the rover. In 1/6 gravity, it wasn't long before the rover started sliding sideways down the mountain. Ooh. James had to catch it with his own two hands. Mission Control did not have a live video feed during this time, so the guys kept it on the down low.
Secret adventures. Wait, what does that mean that he stopped it with his own two hands?
Just grabbed it.
Like, grabbed it and
hopped out and grabbed onto it and like pulled back on it.
Whoa.
And then the last thing is, which falls faster in a vacuum, a feather or a hammer? So there is a fairly famous video you can find on YouTube. It's an astronaut drops a hammer and drops a feather at the same time. And of course, they will fall, Newton's laws, they'll fall at the same rate in no atmosphere, if there's no air.
Or insignificant atmosphere.
And right. Did that turn out to be true?
So it says, David wanted to test out the feather and hammer drop right away because there was a risk that static electricity could cause the feather not to drop. Just stick to your hand.
Oh.
For this reason, he brought two feathers with him, one for the video recorded demo and the other to test it first. Fortunately, the demo was a huge success. We're greatly amused that David's reaction to the successful experiment is, how about that? Even though he tested it first. That's
right.
Awesome.
Yeah. So he still managed to feign surprise.
There is so much more in this article that I don't have time to go over, but I highly recommend, if any of this was interesting to you, go ahead and read this article. It's up at geekspeak.org.
And where did it come from originally? Where did you find it?
Hackaday.com is where it's posted, or probably one of the places it's posted.
Okay. All right. So you'll be able to find that at geekspeak.org. All right. So there's something that you showed me, Lyle, that you were terribly, terribly amused by. And it's from
the city of Paradise Valley in Arizona.
Okay.
There's about 13,000 people that live there.
Okay.
And they, it's Arizona, so the normal fauna in Arizona. Flora or fauna? Flora.
Flora.
Flora. Cactus is pretty common.
Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of cactus.
So, the saguaro cactus, the big lumpy ones.
The cigar cactus, exactly.
Yeah, spikes.
So they, the police department put these cacti in the center of turns areas.
Of the roundabouts.
Yeah. They're made of plastic. They look like they're made of plastic, and they have camera holes in them. And the camera holes are like obvious, you know, good 4-inch diameter holes with cameras in the inside looking out at you.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And there's this great little video of this woman going, I don't know why they did this. It's really ugly. This is another attempt of the police department to track vehicles. It's great when they're stolen vehicles. These cameras actually record license plates and compare them to databases of stolen cars. But they actually keep the records on file for a long time. We have first heard about this tactic of police departments on GeekSpeak, on this show, in 2009, mm-hmm. April 11th in 2009. We had Sergeant Dean Ackerman come on GeekSpeak to talk about other things, about internet fraud and support and fighting internet fraud, because that was his role. Mm-hmm. And he casually, while on the show, mentioned that the San Jose Police Department has a whole bunch of cars driving around, actually three cars at the time, that would record license plates, and they keep a database of these on file. And now every one of their vehicles does this, mm-hmm. which basically means at any point they can find out the history of a vehicle in San Jose or in any of these cities that do this over the last 5-10 years, where it is every day, what this road is, and all of that information.
With some holes, but you can extrapolate where the vehicle is.
So, useful for law enforcement, creepy for us.
Creepy for everybody, especially if it looks like a giant cactus.
Right.
With very, very clearly no thorns, actually. Are they thorns on a
cactus? It's like a bad Halloween costume of a cactus.
It's a bad Halloween.
And no spikes.
With giant cameras. Yeah.
No spikes on these. They're
no
sleek.
That's what spikes.
They were naked plastic cactus.
Were they so shiny?
Gaping
good
holes.
Job, Paradise Valley. Just imagine, imagine you were to make one out of clay and paint it. It's kind of like, I don't know. It looks really dumb.
Yeah.
But you can see it at geekspeak.org with a great little video.
So the lampoonable cactus
Absolutely.
Driver's license camera trackers. See it at geekspeak.org. That's pretty funny. Hey, I just wanted to mention really quickly that that whole thing. Some people may have seen this.
Uh-huh.
There's a map maker. It's from Google.
Sure.
So if you see that there's been a change in something, you can update Google Maps.
Mm-hmm. Crowdsourcing mapping information.
Information. And then it all went awry because people were vandalizing and showing little androids peeing on apples and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's right. The kind of famous one where somebody actually made it look like a giant Android logo was defacing an Apple logo. And that was a real structure on the planet Earth.
Yeah.
And a bunch of people were like, oh my God, I can't believe Google took this cheap shot at Apple. But although it was a Google product, it was someone using the map maker to allegedly report something about Earth that should be in Google Google Maps, but instead was this.
There's another piece of vandalism that looks like it should be a kilometer wide that says Google review policy is crap. And it was basically pointing out that there were holes and like people could post stuff up without it being reviewed.
No, that actually exists. It's a very strange looking mountain range.
No, it's not true. he's not done it.
You know, in the gaming parlance where you have online games where lots of people participate and actually can build stuff, the term for this, the technical term is TTP. That is time to penis. It is the time at which it takes before someone actually makes a phallus in the system.
Okay, because that's an inevitable
state
ploy
of the system. Yeah. In fact, when you see game systems that restrict what you can build, that's why.
Well, so, I hope you're happy, vandals.
Google, of course, has to handle that by taking down the ability to edit.
Which is what's happening. So the map maker is down. Map maker down.
That's why we can't have nice things, right?
That's why we can't have nice things. Of course, you can have Geekspeak anytime you like. Geekspeak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence and is used with permission. And Geekspeak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0, so we use our stuff any way you like. Just cite your sources. Come on, people. This is Public Radio for the Central Coast, 88.9 KUSP Santa Cruz, live online at KUSP.org. To find out more about this or any episode of GeekSpeak, please visit GeekSpeak.org. You can email us at geeks@geekspeak.org and contact us on Twitter. We're at KUSPGeeks. Our theme song is by Michael Newman of Pet Star Music. I'm Bonnie Jean Primsch with Lyle Troxell and Ben Jaffe. Thanks to our intern, Chandler. Hello to our Canadian correspondent, Greg Merkley. And thank you for being here for the May 16th, 2015 episode of GeekSpeak.